Meditation.
Meditation.
Depending on the quality of my mind.
You know, there's good days and bad days.
I mean,
days
I just feel like the waterfall of thoughts. And every now and then, a nice calm.
I can't think of anything.
This is Meditation in the City.
The Shambhala New York Podcast.
And I'm Dave, your host. Thanks for listening yet again to the podcast. Dr. Shante Smalls is a regular contributor to the podcast. She's a scholar, writer, teacher. A lot of her teaching and research focuses on Black popular culture and music, film, visual art, genre fiction, and other aesthetic forms. This was a talk she gave at her weekly Dharma gathering a few weeks ago, and it's called The Dharma of Black Lives Matter. Dr. Smalls talks about the history, the development of the Black Lives Matter movement, its progression, its relationship to meditation, its relationship to the history of the Buddha, the historical Buddha himself. Where are the intersections? What does the Black Lives Matter movement have to illustrate, to teach us about these traditional teachings of suffering and compassion? And further, what does meditation have to do with confronting white supremacy, other forms of oppression? How do we bring our contemplative practice to social change? So that's a lot. This is a meaty talk, but this is a great talk. I'm glad you're listening. I think all of us will get some illumination out of this talk. Visit our website, inmy.shambhala.org, for all of our upcoming courses and weekend retreats. I also want to point out that the Shambhala Meditation Center of New York hosts a racism and racial inequality group. And this is an open forum for reflection, sharing, discussing issues of race within our community, the Shambhala Buddhist community, and society at large. It's a great opportunity to examine personal experiences, habitual patterns, and to practice, actually working compassionately and skillfully with each other, having difficult conversations, having open, heartfelt conversations. The next meeting is on March 8th. For more information, go to our website, inmy.shambhala.org, for this and all of our offerings, community offerings, and courses and retreats. Okay, here is Dr. Shante Smalls.
So about a year ago, maybe a little less, I realized that I wanted to bring the message of Black Lives Matter to the Dharma in relationship to this Dharma Center. And I thought, okay, Black History Month, Black Futures Month makes sense. It's a time to do that. And I wanted to think about really having conversations, or at least beginning conversations about how do we bring our so-called contemplative practices to social realities? And what could that possibly do? What does sitting on the cushion have to do with eradicating white supremacy or valuing Black lives in this particular case, in this particular talk? Does anyone not know what Black Lives Matter is? Okay. Do you know the three women who started it? Their names? Patrice Kahn-Colers, who has a book out called When They Call You a Terrorist, a memoir about her, what happened to her life after she became part of Black Lives Matter. Alicia Garza is probably the most famous of the three. Opal Tamate. So these three women who are of African descent, two are Afro-Latina, two are queer. After the spectacular death and murder and of Trayvon Martin, and then the acquittal of George Zimmerman, felt a sense of rage and a sense of a need for a groundswell to put to words, at least, that the way that Black people in the U.S., but it's expanded beyond the United States, all across the globe, live and die is something that is a matter of importance. And the reason I called this talk the Dharma of Black Lives Matter, because when the historical Buddha, Buddha Shakyamuni, woke up and became an enlightened human being, or as I like to say, he became a real human being, he became fully human, he did that through suffering, through seeing the world as it was, which he had never, ever seen. Some people say he was a prince and he was in the castle, but it was more likely he was like a chieftain's son and he was kind of sheltered. And during his Saturn returns, that's when he woke up. He ventured out and tried lots of different things, all the different aesthetic practices that were there and aesthetic practices. And he's like, this is not quite it. There's something blocking the touching of the heart, the heartbreak. Can't cover over this, can't get away from being a human. That's what we are. I mean, he didn't say it like that. That's my paraphrasing. And so he saw death, which he had never seen before. He saw a corpse in the street. He saw old age, sickness, and he saw suffering. And he said, I think there's something we can do. We can work with this. So these women, building on the long history of Black femme activism, said, Black Lives Matter. And don't you know that caused an uproar? So what's really interesting about Black Lives Matter or any kind of sense of Black empowerment in the history of the United States is that it is always met with violent backlash. If you know the history of this country in particular, and maybe this all of North America, there's a way in which there are a lot of false equivalencies. So we got All Lives Matter, Blue Lives Matter. I was like, they're blue people? Like, where? Because I want to meet a blue person. A uniform is not a... And there was an attempt to kind of denigrate that really powerful message. Pitbull Lives Matter. I mean, I'm like, you know, I'm a pitbull owner, but it's like, really? Find your own message. And, you know, if you look and read their work, they talk about not just the egregious and kind of obvious murders, right, by the state, which is these spectacular kind of things that happen, but it's becoming more mundane because every year the United States is, police around the United States are killing more and more people. There's a project called, the Guardian called, I'm forgetting the name of it, but they track shootings and do a bio of every person who was shot by the police, whether they were armed or unarmed, race, age, gender, mental capacity, so forth. It's heartbreaking. The counted is what it's called, the counted. But if you read their words of these three women, or listen to them talk, they talk about not just sort of these egregious, you know, murders, which are horrific, but these more subtle or more systemic ways that Black life is undone in the afterlife of chattel slavery. Whether it's housing discrimination, the negative effects of gentrification, we know about that in New York. What kind of food ends up in the stores in Black neighborhoods, and how that food changes depending on who moves into the neighborhoods. Discrimination in health, mental health, physical health. So did y'all ever read about how there was interviews with medical doctors and like a year or two ago, and maybe it was medical students, but also practicing doctors who really believed that Black people did not feel pain. So these are people who are trained to heal. And they're like, oh, Black people have a different relationship to pain. They don't feel as much pain, or they have a higher threshold for pain. So this is, in academia, we talk about the afterlife of slavery. And the afterlife of slavery is like it's never died, because we have the prison system and the criminal justice system that is concentrated on Black and brown people and mentally disabled people. And so what happens when you come to the cushion and you've been told your whole life that you are not worthy? And then as the intersections connect, right, maybe you're a Black queer femme man, or maybe you're Black queer femme genderqueer person, or maybe you're a trans woman, or maybe you're working class, or maybe you're Black and fat, or maybe you're dark skinned and Black and fat and trans. And you're told your whole life you don't matter. Or you only matter in a way that's your labor. Like the way that Tarana Burke's labor, a decade of labor, has been co-opted by elite white women. And I say that not to say that Me Too can't be a global movement, but that she is literally erased from a decade of work that she created because Alyssa Milano tweeted the hashtag Me Too. And it's not like, oh, you did this work, like, let's bring you along. Some people have done that. It's like, get out of the way. You know, like she wasn't featured on the Time. You know, that's not everything, but it's like, why is Taylor Swift on it? She didn't do nothing. I'm saying. Anyway. I know you like Taylor Swift, Stephen, so I won't. No tea, no shade. So I'd like to read a little something by this Zen Reverend Zenju Earthlin Manuel. And this book is called The Way of Tenderness, Awakening Through Race, Sexuality, and Gender. Oh, before I read this, I want to just say something that when I first came to Shambhala, particularly the weekly Dharma gatherings, I noticed, and it was never explained to me. So you sometimes see usually femme women serving the teacher, water and tea. Water service and tea service is genderless. However, we know how these things go, where I notice that usually men or cis men, for the most part, don't serve teachers unless they're like really important teachers. And water service, giving a teacher water and tea is so, once I was, when I first started training, I'd do this too, and I'd be like, you know, shaking and, because it's so heartfelt to offer refreshment to someone who's teaching us. And sometimes it's taken for granted. And I don't take Louise or anyone for granted who does incredible service so that I can manifest fully. And so these are things at this very micro level that we have to work out here, where we can replicate the systems of oppression in the world through in our wakeful community. Women in the kitchen. Right? Guys driving or whatever, I don't know, whatever the thing is. So that there's a sense of we come in here and we don't suddenly drop the ways we are out there. This community is a microcosm of the world. What's different is that we're really working with our shit, hopefully. Some of us are not. But I just wanted to say that. So the pain of disregard was embedded early in my life, Reverend Manuel writes, growing roots that eventually proved to be invasive and dangerous to the core of my being. She continues, growing up, I had never been asked who I was. I was told who I was. There was no room for self-discovery. I was told from a young age that my life was going to be a particular way because of my dark skin. And in fact, I did experience the struggles of growing up as a black girl child. Based on what I experienced, I accepted the story of what was predetermined for black people, feeling completely destined for tragedy. I imagined I would have to fight all my life to get what I wanted out of it. I imagined dying unfulfilled. I believed that I did not have access to the resources for life and that access to them was being denied or withdrawn by the powers that be. All of that was true from one narrow perspective, but there was more. Only in the deep silence of meditation did I begin to disbelieve that I was born only to suffer. Eventually, after many years of sitting meditation, I recognized the root of my self-hatred, both external and internal, as a personal and collective denial or denigration of the body I inhabited. So this is one of the reasons I choose to emphasize the body. Not that we're just bodies, but that we actually have a body, this black body. And that sometimes when you come into meditation situations or, you know, spiritual yoga situations, it's like, oh, yeah, we leave that behind. We're, you know, we're going to meditate and we're all one and ring, dun, 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 you know, whatever. And it's like, and they call that spiritual bypassing, right? Where you make room, you embed your violence in the situation and call it spirituality. Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche wrote a book called, thank you. I was like, bumping off spiritual materialism, cutting through spiritual materialism. So this idea that we just collect spiritual practices and then we're float above the world. But, you know, this practice and a practice like Black Lives Matter asks us to be in the muck and the grime of the world, right? Right? And not just cry and be like, that's so sad. But to really ask, how do I benefit from this matrix system? When I walk into the Shambhala Center, where are the black people? I mean, y'all here tonight, you showed up and showed out, so, you know, okay. But that was one of my first questions. Where, I mean, this, you know, this is a Black Lives Matter talk, but I'm going to direct this question to the people who identify as white. How many spaces do you go to where you're the only one? On a regular. Not like, oh, I'm in Bed-Stuy, you know. Help, you know, whatever. You know, Marcus Garvey or something. Not like Herkimer or whatever, you know. But like where do you go regularly where you're the only white person or one of? Are your doctors white? Are your therapists white? Your yoga teachers white? Your dentists white? Your teachers, were they white? You know what I'm saying? And so when we say Black Lives Matter, we're like, there's a sense of that if there are three black people in a room of 100, that's diverse. Or a gang or something, you know? Y'all know it's true. And that's a very painful situation. It's not just diversity. It's an expression of the comfort we have with white supremacy. It's an expression of the comfort we have with white supremacy manifesting itself over and over again, as if this is the norm. And that there's nothing we can do about it. We're helpless. And so when, you know, Sandra Bland was murdered, I swore that I knew her. I mean, you could not tell me. I was like, are we related? Like, I really was like messed up. She would have been 32 last week. Or 12-year-old Tamir Rice. 12 years old. He was considered dangerous. So being a child or being a woman does not protect black life from the ravages of the system that built this country, which is genocide of indigenous people and enslavement and genocide of Africans. It's in our earth. So, just want to say a couple of things, and I'd actually like us to break into quads, do a little work, have conversation with each other. When I came to Shambhala, I had been practicing on and off since I was a teenager. And, you know, I was like a pretty... Anyway. I thought a lot of myself. And I came to Shambhala broken. Like in hospice, emotionally. And it was like my habitual patterns caught up with me. And I couldn't... I ran out of ground. Right, I ran out of hiding places. And I had been listening to, I had been reading Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche's books and reading Pema Chodron's books, and I Googled and realized there was a place in Chelsea, and I started coming to the weekly Dharma gatherings. And what I heard here, for me, I had been a member of a couple of other Buddhist communities, but when I heard basic goodness, I heard that the Shambhala view is that we are inherently worthy, and that no matter how terrible we are or terribly we're treated, that it cannot be destroyed. And we can manifest like a horrible, horrible person and harm a lot of people, or we can manifest as a wakeful being. And we always have a choice. And I remember thinking, oh, like what if, a lot of people need to hear this. But first I needed to hear it and practice. And in the last handful of years, Shambhala as an organization, which has about, I don't know, I never know, a couple hundred centers and groups around the world, we started being like, why are the two centers in Africa filled with white people? Why are we not able to magnetize people of color to Shambhala? In what is going on? Because this message is so profound, and the guys who, you know, these guys aren't white. They're dark, you know? You know, Ali Wong, the comedian, she says the difference between civilized Asians and jungle Asians. One's light, one's dark. Anyway, that's, so there's like, these are dark-skinned people. Who were driven from their land and survived all kinds of horrors and brought, Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche brought his culture here. And the Sakyong grew up in refugee camps. And some of us were really like, what are we doing? We're stuck in this pattern of, it looks just like it looks out there. All, you know, the center here, 5 years ago, pretty much all the teachers were white men. Not all, but many. You know, of a certain age. And there's been a real shift that, like, we all can teach. We all can practice. This young man right here.
What's up? So, big question I want to ask is, why should, like, black people start coming to Shambhala? Why should they start getting into it?
You shouldn't if you don't want to.
Right, exactly, I mean, exactly. True.
Like, that's...
But like, if you're going to ask, like, what can we do for them?
Yeah.
I don't know. You should be willing to, like, market it a little more.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, right. Go out into the world.
Yeah.
This is in conversation, like, why aren't we doing pop-ups in places rather than asking people to come to Chelsea?
Yeah.
You know? So my main concern is not that black people come to Shambhala, it's that black people feel like they can have access to the deep wisdom of Buddhism, which is 2,500 years old, and change the whole world, right? Predates all other major religions. And that we prioritize our... You know, self-care is like a buzzword, but that's real. We prioritize really healing ourselves. And I just want to make meditation available. So how can we use these resources here?
So can I follow that up?
Yes, please.
So I'm a big fan of the idea of heroes.
People
mm-hmm. will be more inspired or likely to do things once they know it's possible, right? Like, take the Black Panther movie, for instance.
You can definitely take that.
You can feel the energy in the
yes.
air. It's like something that's like, it's like, this is something that can happen. Maybe find some way to put, like, black monks and black meditators, like, on blast. Put, get the word out about
yeah,
them.
That's right.
Yeah, I'm done.
Okay.
Hello.
Hello.
Thank you for, I don't know, your message to the Shambhala people. I just wanted to say that I know exactly what you're talking about as far as, like, Black Lives Matter and all that stuff, because I can relate to all of those things as far as, like, mental and spiritual or whatever, physical oppression. I could relate to all of that.
Yeah.
And actually, it's funny because those things that you mentioned, I used to deal with like love and compassion. I didn't feel much hate towards people, but these days I really do feel hate sometimes.
Mm.
And it's hard. It's hard because it doesn't feel right. It's not natural for me. But I know it's not natural. It's not real, but it's deep-seated now because I feel like people are, like, against me. Like, I feel like that police type of thing. I feel like that.
Yes.
And Black Lives Matter and all people matter, you know. But Black lives are very interesting because they're rooted to, like, the history of the world, you know. So when you say Black lives, you're talking about you're talking about world history. You're not talking about Black history. You're talking about world history. And, like, a lot of the people from, I mean, you could even say Kemet, Kush, you know, Africa, wherever, India, they were pretty much brown people in the beginning. Well, at least that's what we were told. But, I mean, even Buddha, the fourth Buddha, supposedly was a black man. I don't know if you know the original statues of Buddha were black. It was a black man. It wasn't an Asian man. And that's why he has the beaded hair. That's the only thing that they left behind. But he was a black man, too. He was actually an Indian prince, but he was from, supposedly, this is one of the stories, but they say that the Nagas, I know they say that the Nagas are bad spirits, they're serpentine spirits, but the Nagas also, which like Nagasaki, Nagares, they were the people of Asia, the Africans of Asia. Yeah. And you have Nagaland in India, and you have all of that stuff. And they used to travel, they call it the West Wind, from Africa to India. Which is weird because it's in the east, but they called it the West Wind, and they would travel from Africa to India. And he was one of those people, supposedly, through one of these stories.
Sure.
And, so I mean, African-American history or black history or whatever history, it's world history.
That's right.
And it's including everybody. It's not just including black people, white people, Indian, Hispanic. It doesn't matter. It's all people because we're all pretty much one and the same. If you look at our DNA, it's like 99.9 or 99 point something, pretty much the same. It's almost identical.
Yes.
So, I mean, looking at color and race and all of that is just separation. It's designed to keep us away from each other, which is sad because we're all one and the same. So, yeah,
thank you. So you know a lot about Buddhist history. The Nagas are actually not considered negative. They're lower beings are part of the ecosystem, but it is said that it is most precious to be born as a human, so not in the god realm, not in the animal realm, not in the hell realm, not in the lower realms, because a human can hear the Dharma and pass it on and practice. So an animal can hear it, but and the god realm people can hear it, but they're like, I'm all good, right? And in the lower realms, there's too much suffering, so they can't even hear it. But when we talk about Black Lives Matter, it's important not to jump to we're all one. I don't think anyone doesn't think that. We have to look at our reality on the ground, not the ultimate reality. We get the ultimate reality. Oh, we're all one, we're stardust. But that's not hard. And we'll all be united once there's an alien invasion, right? Aryan invasion. Oh, barbarian, okay. One of them. So, but what we're talking about here is the specificity of black life, and I want to stay on that note, right? Like we're singers and we hold our note. We don't sing the note around us. We stay on our note because there's people are upset that the British Museum just said, oh, yeah, the first Brits were black with blue eyes. And people are like rioting. So that there's a whole, I once had a student who said that he didn't know that black people went to college before 1965. And I was like, oh boy. So it's like we're in, you know, when people think of the African continent, which people know it's a continent, right? Not a country. That they think of like a blank instead of the place with the most richest resources and most diverse populations and just incredible, you know, modern cities like Nairobi or Dakar, Cape Town, and then beautiful, you know, bushland and elephants that are, and rhinos and, you know, the tech boom. And people who are still living in very traditional ways. So there's all of humanity, but that's not how it's taught, depicted, related to. So we have to think about the relative world and how tonight we're really trying to stay with and sink into what it feels like to say and hold the value of black life. Specifically, we want to get other people. We can, you and I can definitely talk after. So this is not a we are all one talk. It's not a liberal humanist talk. We know we value white life. That's not right. When a white man murders multiple people, what happens to him? He's given a burger, like Dylann Roof, taking a Burger King. So we have some kind of view about the valuing of those lives, even in the most kind of egregious behavior, right? There's some value in of human life, of someone who's taken human life, but there's not that, it's not equal. It's not, in our society is made up of human beings who have belief systems that become systems, our political systems, our social systems, our economic systems. So we're trying to interrupt that. Like for real, for real. Not as a joke or as a thought experiment or as a think piece, but as a way of living. And it's very hard.
Something that came to me, like one of the things that's important, especially for, well, I shouldn't say especially for Dharma teachers. I'm not talking about you in particular, but sometimes in making references about things and talking about the Dharma or something, a lot of times they talk when they say, the poorest, they'll say the poorest place, and then I'm like, here it comes, in Africa.
Mm.
Like, people say that so often with no thought, and a lot of things like that. And when I heard it one time here, I was so annoyed, because here again, just using these, it's not like, no, we're not like people. When you want to reference something horrible and tragic, let's go to Africa. It's like, there's horrible, tragic things
the poorest
everywhere.
People in New York City.
There are poor people here in Alabama. And that's right. But it's always disease in Africa. Like, every place you want to say the worst things. And I think it's important to think about what you're saying and what you're thinking. And you may not be aware of it, but because it's so part of our language.
Yes.
We just say it because that's everyone else is saying it. When you count the number of times you hear some type of reference like that on the news,
yes,
or in a discussion, you always go to Africa for anything horrible. And stuff like that, we got to get a hold of, because that's also part of Black Lives Mattering, We're people. We're human beings with multiple stories, diverse stories.
Yes.
I mean, there's some freaking rich people in Africa, billionaires.
Some of the richest people in the world.
Yeah, and you know, we don't think about that, but I think that's very important, especially for, like, we talk about what can we do for Shambhala, is like the teachers need to really think about what they're saying and the type of references they're making. And one of the things, when I started coming here, I fell in love with Shambhala, and then after a while, certain things kind of annoyed me, is when you're giving a talk and references are totally out of reach. Like, I get what you're saying, but everything is not, so many things are so out of reach.
Yes.
For every, well, I should say everyone, for certain groups of people.
Yeah.
And particularly, I felt like, okay, this is not part of my world, but I understand what they're saying. And you need more people who have diverse experience,
That's
who
right.
could speak to everyone.
That's right. The Dharma doesn't come in one language, and it's very troubling when everyone has like the same party line and the same cultural references. It's very weird. I mean, the Vijayadara Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche was an Anglophile. So he brought a lot of that. And when he came to the US, the people he encountered, I mean, some of them are in this room, many of them were trying to escape. They were part of the counterculture. And so from my view, as someone who wasn't, you know, born yet or part of that culture, is that there was a, you know, there's no grounding in, it's like, oh, this Tibetan guy, I'm going to grab that. And even he didn't really know. I've never seen him write about any connection between this very important symbol we talk about, the Ashe in Shambhala, and Ashe as a, you know, complete African cosmology. There's a book, I can't remember the name of it, I have it in my phone, about African Candomblé and Tibetan Buddhism. And so there are all these ways in which there's knowledge, and there was travel, and there was, and we can bring that. It's not an additive, like we're not faking it. It's actually real. And I contemplate, what is the connection between, you know, West African Ashe and the Tibetan Ashe? There's something very, you know, this, I have it tattooed on my body, you know what I mean? So this symbol of wakefulness. And so I think that it's really a decolonization project. Decolonizing Buddhism, Western Buddhism, totally. And really, you know, modeling it differently. Please enjoy the food, enjoy each other, and if you would like to join me in bowing out, that would be great.
Well, all right. Thanks. Thank you, Dr. Shante Smalls. Thank you for listening to this podcast. Hey, spread the word, will you? Please? We like it when you do that. Email us at podcast@shambhalanyc.org. Your questions, comments, suggestions. If you live in a different city, there's probably a Shambhala Meditation Center near you. But if you are in the New York City area, come to our weekly Dharma gathering. It's every Tuesday night at 7 o'clock. You can hear talks like this, live and in person. You can meet the other people. You can enjoy some nice hors d'oeuvres from the neighborhood Trader Joe's. It's a fun time. And of course, check out our website, nymyshambhala.org, for all of our weekend retreats, weeknight courses, and community events. Thanks for listening. Later.